Joe Murray from Helium. Did you want to respond to anything on the tape? Learning objects, learning object repository projects, Storm. We've got Storm in the later questions.
Yeah, we'll deal with Storm
and
later.
Is there, I don't think I took any notes that require specific.
I mean, my worry is the standards that are being imposed to some extent.
Yeah.
And those sorts of things. We need to work our way through that. And the repackaging of toolboxes is taking an old piece of content that covers anywhere up to 80 hours worth of work and trying to repackage it into a 3 or 4 hour block. And it's a lot of retrospective work.
So are you saying that because the reason that standards don't matter is that if you publish how you create your stuff, then people can consume it anyway? Is that your...
Yeah.
So if it's transparent, it doesn't take long to consume.
Look at RSS, which... I mean, RSS undoubtedly works. I mean, millions of RSS feeds, RSS readers all over the place, so on and so forth. Insofar as that's a standard, it's the most ridiculous standard you've ever seen. In fact, it isn't a single standard. It's 9 separate standards plus extensions. No 2 RSS feeds look the same. But the thing is, people know how it's produced. They're able. So, like, I write an aggregator. I can sit there and say, okay, here's kind of what RSS does, roughly, loosely. I'll pull these files. I'll get this information from them. I'll ignore that information. If they don't have such and such information, I'll make something up. It's the old, be adaptable in what you consume, and the concept behind standards is you can only consume it if everybody does it exactly the same way. Imagine if language worked that way, right? There would be no accents. There would be no localized jargon or things like that. People will communicate in different ways. So, but if we have enough information so that we can do some sort of handshaking process, we're away to the races, and then we adapt. So, I mean, that, and so, I like standards, but I don't like the concept of standards, right? I like the word protocols much better than standards. Protocol is a much better word, because a protocol suggests the agreement between the two sides, and the voluntary agreement between the two sides, and it represents the idea that it's going to be shifting, it's going to move around a little bit. I had to change the way I produced my EduRSS feeds, not because the standard changed. Standard's been the same, such as it is, forever, but because the way the community was using the standard sort of evolved a little bit, and so now my EduRSS feeds no longer validate as RSS, but they're in a form that can actually be better used by existing aggregators. I mean, that's the world of RSS, right? The invalid stuff works better than the valid stuff. It's protocols, it's agreements. We draw a line between two people, between two systems, between two units in our network, if and only if those two entities have enough in common and a common need in order to make a communication, and not otherwise. SCORM, very briefly on SCORM. SCORM is something that's adapted for a very specific purpose, and the specific purpose is to take training manuals, put them on a disk, or put them in some kind of package, ship them out to battleships somewhere out in the Arabian Sea, and thus provide training to people who are busy fighting a war. That's SCORM. That's what SCORM does. The idea that model would be applicable across the board is utterly ridiculous. And people know this. I mean, Dan Rehack wrote a thing, is SCORM useful for higher education? And came to the conclusion, well, no. Because higher education works on a very different model. Higher education isn't battle training manuals. That's a good which is good. No, actually, well, and this is an interesting thing. This is something that the military is wrestling with. One of the things that the U.S. military, I've had U.S. military people talk to me, and one of the things that they talk about, one of the reasons for their success is that a field commander does have a certain amount of autonomy in the field, and therefore is much more able to react to changing circumstances than a large centralized army. When Mikhail Gorbachev was visiting Washington for incredibly important peace talks, there was an earthquake, and he had to fly. He himself had to fly back right away to Russia because nothing could be done in the way of earthquake relief without Gorbachev actually being there to get the system going. Contrast that. Where was it? Was it? It was in a book I read recently. I think it was Duncan J. Watts' Six Degrees, or it might have been, I'm pretty sure it was that, or it might have been the book titled The Wisdom of Crowds, one of those two, talking about Toyota, and there was a fire at, I think it was a bearing plant, or some plant that produced a crucial component for Toyota. Toyota, over the years, has developed just-in-time inventory, which is great. It means they don't have to control inventory. And they've also developed a network of suppliers. So there's Toyota, and then there's 100 or 150 separate companies surrounding Toyota. So it's really this group of companies, and these companies supply all the parts and services to make Toyota. There's a fire at one of these plants, and burned to the ground, completely destroyed. It's the only plant that made this component. So all of Toyota production was stopped. When inventory ran out, and inventory was just a day or so. So, as this story goes, because the system was sufficiently adaptable, the network reinvented this process from the ground up by working independently and autonomously. They got back into production in a couple of days. Still cost us hundreds of millions of dollars to stop for a couple of days. But you just imagine what that would have done to Toyota and to Japan generally if they hadn't been able to do that. But it was this decentralized, we'll create the communication protocols as needed. We'll create the direction as needed. If there was anything like a hierarchical command and control management of the supply network for Toyota, the company would have ceased to exist. Another great example is Cantor Fitzgerald. Cantor Fitzgerald, their offices were located at a very unfortunate location of the World Trade Center. And, of course, they had a fire. And it turns out that most of the employees of the company were killed. There's still a few hundred left over. And I said, we're stubborn. We're going to keep this company going. So they went to restart. And all of their records, of course, they were smart, and their records were distributed. But what had never occurred to them is every single person who knew the passwords to access the records were killed. They had no password access. Their management, all gone. So nobody's in charge. Yet they rebuilt because they created a communication system, and by passing information, little bits of information, who knew would be useful, back and forth, they were able to reconstruct the passwords based on what they knew of the people, because people, at least some people, had predictable enough passwords that people who knew them closely and took part in this useless office gossip had the information that they needed in order to come up with the passwords and get the company going and be ready for work the next Monday, because they didn't work on the stock exchange. They worked on a different exchange, and it didn't close. So, and they were able to do it. Incredible story. But the message is the single, centralized, one-way-fits-all model won't work. Does not work. Cannot work. And history is full of examples of that sort of thing.
We might move on, if you don't mind.
Sorry.
No, that's great, but I know others have got things to
yeah,
say.
Yeah,
so, Joe, could we move on to yours, please? And I think that's a good lead into it on some form of knowledge management.
Yeah, yeah. Stephen, I've been working on a e-journal for the Live Flexible Learning League over the last couple of years. And that may or may not continue next year. So I'm just interested in, on a national level, what are some of the most workable and interesting ways to be knowledge sharing that we could conceivably convince the framework to engage in? So I'm not talking about what's possible for people like you, but what we might be able to convince them to do that will continue what we've tried to do, which is just to get vocational practitioners who have no culture of publishing to share their information. And it's been specifically around the Flexible Learning Leaders research, I suppose, but we've had quite a lot of other contributors, and it's now started to get a little bit of a get some legs, so people are sort of seeing that it's worthwhile and are coming from all over the place and offering things for contribution. Now, these are people that could, yes, do their own blogs, but they don't. So this is another way of mentoring them to publish. So my question is, I guess, how that can go to the next level without requiring... Because it needs some sort of coordination from what I've experienced, because of there isn't a culture of publishing. There's no credit points in it for vet practitioners to publish. And the information we want to get out there is just really what's happening now on the ground, how we can help other people. And this is just one place that people will visit. I don't know, just any general comments on where you think the framework might go. The difference between this is an e-journal with no password access and the community, which is a password thing. The framework website itself, which is also offering now topic alerts and RSS feed. Edna's also doing that, so it's the place. I'm wondering, where is the place for practitioners who haven't published before, who we would like to continue to assist to publish? What sort of mechanisms do you think would be an improvement on the sort of things that we've got happening now?
Okay. Just thinking about how to start this. I know what I want to say, but
that's why I like the microphone. Play with the microphone a little bit, gives me a little stalling time. The key things. I pulled three key things out of what you said, and not necessarily the three key things you wanted me to pull out. At least one was an offhand quip that wasn't, I'm sure, a part of what you wanted to say. First thing you said was, and this is a direct quote, "I'm not interested in what's possible for you." Now, I understand why you said that, but I found that important. The second thing was, there's no tradition of publishing among the people that you're trying to reach. And the third thing is, they could do blogs, but they don't. Well, so the first part of the message is, nothing is ever going to get simpler than blogs for publishing. Therefore, it's not a technological issue. Right? So, and then the second thing is, and this relates to, I was talking a little bit about this in Adelaide, and it didn't really show up in the slides because of one of these digressions that I make. We have this idea that writing is somehow separate from doing. We have this idea that learning is somehow separate from doing, and that learning is somehow separate from writing, and that all of these things are separate, so that if you want these people to write, it's some kind of task over and above what they're doing. And in fact, the word publishing really suggests this, right? So... Yeah. Yeah. But you want
any sort of sharing.
Right, any sort of sharing. But now, these people are working constantly all day and sometimes into the evening. And a great deal of the work that they're doing involves either the consumption or production of information. In fact, that practically is their job. So the problem isn't that they're not producing stuff. The problem is the mechanism for collecting what they're producing is separate from the mechanism in which they produce. So, you know, to simplify it grossly, it's a logistics problem. Right, it's a gross simplification, but...
So we need a Kazaa for education that distributes all the stuff on their document files.
Well, yeah, it's not a technological problem, right? Kazaa is just another thing, but you're on the right track. But we come back to the first thing, which was, I'm not interested in what's possible for you, right? Because to me, this is the whole key, right? Because I'm busy too. You know, I'm as busy as anyone. All right. But what I did, because I do these kind of things, is I set myself up a little system whereby, in the course of doing whatever it is that I do, I create information which I can then share. Right, and this isn't like a tacit systems approach, where you know they scan the email going by and grab it on you. This is all completely in my control. But it's called a blog these days. It didn't start out that way. But when I first started doing this, so many years ago, all this was my mechanism for keeping track of what I read and where it was, because I forget things. I have a terrible memory. I have a good memory, but it's very short. And so that's all it was. And it sort of evolved, right? So now, these people are doing research. Where's that information going? And again, I come back to the people around the table using paper. All right? Look at all the content being produced here, but it's not in a shareable form. So... If the desire and intent is to have greater information production and sharing take place, then the mechanisms that allow the production and sharing of this information to take place within the scope of other activities is the approach. And now that gives you a strategy. Still doesn't give you tactics, but that gives you a strategy. And so I would be looking at, and there's going to be all kinds of internal things, right? Because, you know, the internal corporate culture is shared. No! We can't let the world see what we're doing. My life's an open book. Hasn't hurt, actually. Because in my mind, it's kind of helped. I think it's helped a lot. Because all I've done over the years is just share my reading and my thinking. Right? And just in the process of creating it, just a couple simple things over and above that, and it becomes available to the world. This has been huge for me. So, I mean, there's going to be a business, social kind of hurdle you have to get over, and that hurdle is contained in the word publishing. And it's, you know, got to get away from the idea that this is something special, it's got to be a certain special high quality or things like that, because, you know, the highest, you know, it doesn't matter how high quality something is when there's none of it. So.
To do that. I mean, I'm not talking about before or doing it, and it is now really easy to do it, but when you were kind of like starting.
Actually, it takes me the same time now as it did then, because I still use pretty much all the same systems. I've added to them a little bit since, but it has always taken me about an hour to an hour and a half to do OO daily. But what that has always been the time that it takes for me to do things like read my email, read some websites. In other words, this is the time it always took for me to do this work anyways. One of the things that I've done deliberately is set aside, no matter where I've worked, set aside a certain amount of time that I call as my, well, I don't call it anything as I call it in my time, but it's the time when I read my email. It's the time when I just tootle around on websites for no apparent reason. It's the time when I might sit and read a book. I take a certain chunk out of my work day, and this is the time for receiving information. And you have to do that. Because if you're not doing that, then you're working without knowledge. And it doesn't matter how productive you are, you're being productive at the wrong thing. So I take that time, and I insist on that time. And now, strictly speaking, my job is almost entirely that time. Although NRC does like me to be productive, they just don't tell me how. So that kind of works well. And so basically, my email and other reading time is my writing time. And that may seem odd, but that's what happens. So it's very rarely the case that I produce OL Daily outside the scope of what I would be doing anyways. And that's what I've always told people, you know, I would be doing all this reading, all of this note taking anyways, you know. And again, that's why you have to come back to it again, like no computers. If I was at this meeting would produce OL Daily for me. Right, because I'd be getting links, I'd be getting ideas. I've already gotten a bunch of, you know, because I'm sort of the one talking here. I haven't really been able to do anything. Also, I don't have wireless access. But you know, I would just save it in Note tab anyways. But I mean, that's the way it works. So, how to get these people, you know, producing things? Get them into the information age. Get them capturing the work that they're doing as they do it, right? And capturing in a different format, capturing not in the analog paper and pencil format, but in a digital format, so that it can be shared, it can be used. I look at any idea. People talk about IP and all of that. Any idea how much the content of all your papers here is worth right now? It's just. And yet, you're going to waste it. You can put it in the shelf, you'll never see it again. It just kills me.
You right, Jack?
Yeah.
Does that help?
Well, I know anyway, but it's like how.
Well,
how do you deal with that sort of culture? I mean, people are starting to use the, you know, little school movies on these sort of things now. But a lot of our vocational teachers.
Do you do it?
No, whether they write, sit down and write and read your emails and collect information on a daily basis.
I mean, the how is to show them. You can't tell. You have to show them. I mean, the only reason I'm here is because I showed you. Right, and now it becomes your job, right? And you have to show them. You have to do it yourself. And then people will ask you, well, how did you do that? You just say, well, I just do this. And you don't do exactly what I do. You do it your own way. A blog, a management system, an email list, whatever. Just do it digital and then share it. That's all you have to do. Just capture the information as you produce it and then share it. Information you produce anyways. Do you write reports? Share it. You know, simple little thing. Capture it and share it. If you emulate that, then the people who are following you or reporting to you will begin to see that it's of value. But if you don't do that, then they have utterly no incentive to do it. So do it yourself, and they will begin to do it. Don't do it yourself. It doesn't matter what technology you employ, it'll never happen.
That's what we found. We have actually models where we had tools for teachers for planning for the students to their students in that traditional sense. Professional learning teachers were delivering to the teachers. We have to say, right, use the tool, model the use of the tool with the teachers versus the student, so that the teachers can then use the tool to actually work with their classroom students as well.
Are the managers using the tool?
So that's across that board, yeah, they would be in that particular environment requiring that sort of tool and what have you to work in.
If the CEO doesn't read or write email...
Oh, no, that's a given.
Right. Well, look, if the CEO doesn't read or write email, then the information culture in that company is hobbled, crucially, and all the way down the line. So, I mean...
critical to the year that I've had, and there's two other people in the room who reflect with me, who relate to me. We've had lots of discussions around what sort of tools are really useful in capturing information that we can use. And again, I'm looking for open source tools. I mean, for example, I tend to use something straightforward like Word, but when I'm doing websites, I'll use something like the favorites to capture those. But managing those are a pain in the neck in terms of being able to search them. And I know there's some open source tools out there that you can use to manage it better. What sort of systems or what sort of tools do you use that you find most useful that you can share with us?
The tools I built myself.
Yeah. So are there any lookalikes or any pointers that you can give us? Because you really are good at doing this, and many people aren't. And
the only reason I'm good at doing this is I've been doing it for many years.
Yeah. So
when I first started doing this, I wasn't very good at it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I'm still at that stage, so I want to learn from you.
Yeah, there's no special skill there. It's practice, like playing darts. You know, eventually you throw enough, you'll begin to hit the board. Not a very good example, because darts is incredibly frustrating. But, you know, I mean, where did I start? I started using Notepad. And, I started just... a big file, outgrew Notepad in a hurry, but I just put it in the plain text editor because I never have had the time to fuss around with tools. I have no patience for tools. Today, if I was starting, I would use a blog because blogs are searchable, especially like the bloggers in Google, right? The trick to searching a blog, use not only the internal thing, but use Google to search your blog. Just do site, colon, and then your site, and then whatever it is you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And, as you search more, practice. And the thing is, you sort of have to remember that you are actually writing to this blog and putting useful information in there, so that when you are writing a report or doing a paper, that you actually go back to the information that you've stored. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds kind of odd, but of course I'm good, right? But it's amazing, and I find myself doing this too, starting to research all over from scratch when I have a new project to do. So...
Well, you do a Google search and your own blog pops up and you think,
haha,
I did read about that.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Google search. So what I've done now, actually, if you look at the search on my old website, the search on my website is a Google search, which is site-specific. It's very simple to set up.
You can do that in Moodle, too?
I'm sorry,
you could do that in Moodle? Like, we've got a site that's Moodle. Could you do that searching facility within Moodle with that?
It's publicly accessible.
Yeah, it's not going to be accessible to Google, is the problem. Openness always works. Openness is what makes the stuff you created findable again. Right? This has nothing to do with sharing with the world. It's like, by making my stuff open, all of those things that are out there that organize and handle information are suddenly now things that I can use with my own information. So, I would start with a blog. I would, just as things come up, just track them. It doesn't have to be an open public blog. There are ways to have less open, less public blogs. I've got a couple of things that aren't open, but not everything I do is public, because then I would never be invited to things. you can be more public or less public. I tend to the more public, but, it's your call. The main thing is to get it down. Get it down in digital format. Find the simplest interface, or more accurately, find the interface that you're comfortable with. And don't worry about the feature set or the capacities. The key thing is you will use it. So if Word is comfortable to you, use Word, right? And then save the data for later, and then just search your Word files. As time goes by, you will develop, one way or another, more sophisticated ways of handling your information. two or three times, four times, however many times, you'll have to completely reorganize the way you handle your information, because you're now handling information in a more sophisticated way. But you can't reach that point until you start handling the information. With pen and paper, you can only handle it with a certain degree of sophistication, and you reach the limits of that technology. Those limits aren't the same in electronic technology. So there is no magic answer. You know, there's no simple way to get people to do it. It's, you know, model it yourself, do it yourself, make it available, and find the tool that's comfortable.
And make it culturally acceptable in the organization to do so, is the other big one.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, it's this top-down thinking again, right? The whole idea of getting people to do things is, in my view anyways, the wrong approach. Because even if you get them to do it somehow, you know, you threaten to fire them, or you promise, you know, like, if there's no advantage to them in doing it, if they would not do it willingly of their own accord, then you're not going to be successful getting them to do it. So the idea is to create the conditions where it is to their advantage to do it, rather than to directly get them to do it. And then, you know, you phrase it that way, then there become a variety of ways to do it. What are the ways in which it can become to their advantage to do it? Well, if it's easier for them to do it, that helps. And that's, you know, so if they know about blogs at least, and it becomes easy for them to do it, great. You know, if they're in some way rewarded for sharing, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it depends on the individual. It depends on the organization. But the thing is, you can't get them to do it. You really can't get them to do it if you don't do it. But even if you do it, you can't get them to do it. They have to decide to do it. I know that's not the answer you wanted, but that's the answer I have.
No, I understand. I mean, that's where I've been coming from. Encouraging people while modeling sharing. So I get that. It's like, what's the, you know, is there a new direction the framework will go in that would continue that, or are there more directions they should be going in?
Yeah. The short answer is probably not. I mean, the framework overall, I don't know if you're hearing this from your politicians, the framework overall, from my perspective, is one of the more successful initiatives.
I see, we don't hear that.
Yeah.
You know, we hear it gets chopped every year, it gets changed, and then, you know, that's
what it is. Can I just chip in something here in support of what you're saying? And as an example, Kirsty, who here, who's a power blogger from way back, in the Flexible Learning Leaders community this year, 64 people around the country, Kirsty's initial presentation at the induction workshop in April has resulted in the most, well, I think it's been stunning, the pickup amongst the flexible learning leaders of blogging, initiated by Kirsty's presentation and then her generosity in sharing on all sorts of levels. There are, I don't know how many, Kirsty, you might know, there's lots and lots of the flexible learning leaders who are using blogs in various ways. And I don't see why, Joe, in the flexible learning community, making use of the network of flexible learning leaders, past and present, you couldn't leverage off that modelling and actually just promote the use of simple tools like blogging for sharing information and highlight it through the flexible learning community. I mean, we could collectively make that happen.
That's what edition 6 has got, you know, a preview of, the next edition will be all about the leaders and what they're doing, and there's loads of links in there.
But if the journal disappeared because of funding cuts, they would be the community level strategy we could use to keep the value of it going.
Yeah, well, that's
going to happen. Sorry. Great discussion, and I think the solution is blogging. And please.
Thanks, Peter.
That sums it up in three words.
I'm going to have to do something that's rather difficult for me, and that is to condense down into 5 minutes something that I'm actually quite passionate about. But I can do it. I've got therapy for that.
Now, essentially, what we're looking at is mobile learning, and just to give you a really brief idea or concept of what we're on about. Essentially, there's a lot of work, as you're aware, in the learning area worldwide at the moment. What we thought we'd do is actually develop some innovative ways of actually practicing this and documenting this and showing individual case studies of how this can be achieved. What we've actually done is develop some partnerships with industry areas as well as community areas, including the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens and the areas like food and hospitality, and indigenous communities on Cape Barron Island for work with mobile technologies. And the technologies that we're focusing on are things like PDAs. Now I feel very guilty not actually having my little mobile keyboard out here and taking out the detail, because we've got that and the abilities are there and it's available for us now. And in fact, a couple of people who were involved in the project as well, Stephen Brain and Kirsty Sharp. And Kirsty actually goes through a process where I've actually seen her out there in the middle of a conference tapping away at her little fold-out keyboard through her PDA and then using her mobile phone to send her blogs out through to her blog page. So that's all readily achievable nowadays and can be done. But essentially what we're looking at, and the great thing, by the way, as well, just coming back on a point that you made earlier, Stephen, and that is the simplicity of this. You know, you don't have to wait for a boot-up time for these. You're straight into your Word document, straight into Excel, straight into any other type of program that you wish to run on these, and there's quite a versatile and expandable opportunities with these types of devices as well, which people don't really appreciate. But essentially, with our project, the focus has been developing those partnerships with these organisations, with these community groups, and actually establishing close ties so that they actually feel that they own the project as well, and they do own the project, and they actually run with the development side of the resources that have been created for these particular PDAs. They are provided with training to actually undertake that process. So it's been a fantastic experience and a mutually beneficial experience to enable this to happen. We're currently still in the trials, and we should have most of what we're looking at finished by the end of November, so including the Indigenous trials on Cape Barron. Now, what we're looking at is simplicity of programs. We're not looking at high tech necessarily, and we're not looking at high cost as well. These sort of devices can go right up to about $1,400 or $1,500, and a lot of people, it's trendy to get a device that's right up there, right with the top of the end models, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are better than some of the lower cost models. And what we're focusing on is stuff that is cost effective for the business, cost effective for the trainers and the learners involved as well. And also, these devices are regarded by, the age brackets, like the 16 to 24-year-old bracket and up from there, because I'm in bracket above that, as a sexy device. It's attractive to them, and they can use it. So what we're looking at is developing these resources that are essentially just-in-time resources, learning on the job. We're looking at assessment processes, using plug-in cameras, video cameras to take assessment, simple programs that don't cost a great deal that are readily available. Things like Pocket Album, for example, that creates a series of snapshots where you can add voiceover to each snapshot or text to each snapshot. You then save it as a standard display of images, and that can be then beamed to wherever you want it or sent through the GPRS through the mobile network to a central server of some sort. So the opportunities for expansion and exploration with these types of devices is there. They by no means fulfil the complete role of, say, a laptop, but they certainly are very, very portable. They fit in your pocket, and you can use them anywhere, anytime. And that's sort of the catch cry that's being pushed with this type of technology these days. But essentially, that is it in a nutshell. But so a couple of questions that I've got for you there, Stephen, is the mobile learning global and Canadian perspectives, what are they at the moment? What have you seen that sort of stands out in the learning circles there? I've got a couple of other questions if we have time, but that's essentially the main one.
I think in Canada we're about at the same point. In fact, the main thing I was thinking of to say to you as you're going through the first part is to ask you to send me an email sometime after I get back. We do have a largish pilot project going on in the use of PDAs to support mobile learning. I forget off the top of my head what the exact details of that are. They may be in my email, but it's Outlook, so I'll never find it. But if you send me a note, I know NRC is partnering to some degree in that particular project. I'm not personally partnering in it, but our office is. I'll put you in touch with that. So the long and the short of it is, you know, pilot projects, initial stages, exploration. Part of this project also is the production of content for delivery using those vehicles. And it's interesting. You talked a lot about having people use tools like that in order to produce content, whereas the emphasis in my part of the world seems to be to use tools like that to deliver content. And it strikes me that a tool like that would be great at producing content, but not a very good device for receiving or reading content. Because, you know, like the screen width and all of that. They've showed me little flash things that are in a box this big. They work fine. They're flash. But I mean, it seems to me that as time goes by, there should be more of an emphasis on, as they call it, user-created content. And that these tools are a device for that, particularly insofar as it's in conjunction with activities that get them outside of their classroom and into whatever it is they're trying to learn about. Sort of, you know, they want to learn about the trees. They're out in the forest with their PDAs producing content right there on the spot with simple tools about trees.
Yeah, that's a similar project that one of the trial areas is actually focused on the student, the learner actually in the workplace, running with a electronic diary that they can actually take the image of what they're doing, add the comment, and add a voiceover. So from the literacy issue as well, the voiceover adds that little component that is fantastic for many of the learners that we're targeting. So that's that engagement in the field, if you like.
Yeah, I think we're in early days in that, but I think it has a lot of potential. So that probably leaves you time maybe for other questions, although I'm not sure how helpful I'll be. But
essentially, once again, just how do you get away from the gadget syndrome that is perceived by the general population there? And are you saying that we should just get these things out and start using them? And, you know, the bug of the comments, in other words.
That's always been my approach.
Yeah. But nearly always the case, when you bring out one of these, you tend, you know, all the room turns to you. Yeah. And then the questions come. You know.
Well, then that's good.
Sarcasm. Yeah.
The questions are great because, you know, I mean, you can explain what you're up to. But work with younger people. I mean, that's a bit cynical, but I mean, we're in a world right now where, we've got. You know, all the people who are running the show who don't use any of this stuff, and then all the people who are younger people who are learning who do use this stuff to some degree. Although I don't see anything, I don't see your electronic input device or gadget.
He's got one.
His brain, okay.
Name's Brain also.
Yeah. It's kind of ironic. You never know what's going to stick in your mind. It's completely off topic, sorry. But I once read somewhere, it might have been in Dale Carnegie, all things. But it was a little bit of business advice. And it was, if you go to a meeting or anything like that, don't bring paper and books or things like that. And actually, and that's something I've actually practiced over the years. That's some sort of stairs, but so a lot of times when I go to some of these things, right, I don't have a notebook, I don't have a paper, I don't have anything. And I know it sounds like a bit of a contradiction of what I just said, but it's not really. And it's kind of interesting because there'll be this meeting of several people, and all these people have all their notes and all their books and all of this stuff, and it'll be me, I'll have a little bit of blank desk in front of me with my coffee on it, because I always have coffee. And because the thinking was, in this little bit of advice, that the reason you're at this meeting is because for you, right? They want to see you. They don't want to see your notebooks or your gadgets or your things like that. So I'm just looking around. It's interesting. Everybody's got notes and papers and that, except him. So, and the thinking was, right, who's the person you want to talk to? It's the person who's working without a net. So, like I said, completely off topic, but it's true, isn't it?
Just on PDAs, and we've worked as a learning edge with TAFE on the digital rights, but also we have to offer the PDA edition of the learning edge. We'd like to put the effort on them. We're looking, as a way and means to get that to, at the end of the day, for delivery and training or classroom environments. So,
we'd love to.
We're storing some of their PDA objects in our learning and repository.
So. Okay.
Have you done work in wearables? Wearable computing?
No,
it's not. Oh, well, wearable computing is just all the regular stuff, except instead of carrying it around, you wear it. And because I had an iPad, and I used that for a little while, and the connectivity didn't really work on it, and it was clunky, and the main thing is I had to carry it. And I hate carrying things. I really hate carrying things. So I eventually gave it away and didn't use it. But it's wearable. I mean, I've got this neat little audio recording thing, but I have to carry the computer around with me. And if I could just record this audio on the fly without this whole setup, I'd be away to the races.
Smart.
Yeah?
Records about
30 hours. 30 hours? That's pretty good. What happens if the battery dies? It still works?
I just get on the battery.
Yeah, but you don't lose your recording? Because I got one of those, battery died, I lost all my time. Yeah, I like that. But you have to carry it in your pocket. It's just a smaller thing you have to carry. Yeah, that's true, I suppose.
Yeah,
there's that whole world of iPods. Have you done any work with iPods and MP3 players?
Yeah,
that's huge. That's going to change a lot of things.
We need movies working as well.
Pardon?
People want to watch movies. No,
yeah. If you're driving to work, you want to have a movie. Yeah.
You're right, Matt. Thank you very much.
Get a grip, I'm not buying you one.
But that's what...
All right, we might move on to Kirsty Sharp, and thank you very much, Marcus. I acknowledge you have to go.
Do send me that information. I'll get you connected with those other people.
Thanks very much, Dave.
No problem. That'll be more useful than the advice I just gave.
My role at TAFE Tech Tasmania is primarily supporting teaching teams in implementing flexible learning, and that takes a number of different sort of faces. One of my main roles is working on the establishment of flexible learning centres, and a lot of that time is working with teaching teams and how they can use the new spaces well and to their advantage. Another part of my role is working in professional development projects with teams on LearnScope projects, and two this year have been looking at toolboxes for delivery into the workplace, which has brought some interesting challenges in its own. There's a whole variety of other things as part of my work role, but also this year I'm a flexible learning leader, and my project within that is specifically looking at how we can make the most of flexible learning strategies for people who are based in the workplace. Within our organisation, the two sort of groups of practitioners, if you like, overlap a bit, but there is potential, I believe, from some of the work I've done before, in enriching our workplace learning and, to a lesser extent, assessment practice by bringing in some of the other tools that flexible learning teachers use. So I guess my questions to you might be around looking at the integration of work and learning and embedding learning within work, and your response to Joe's question previously to highlight some of the directions already. But I was wondering if you could bring that back to the vocational learner who last week we visited a chocolate factory, and we listened to the managers who are undertaking training, we listened to the shop floor workers who are undertaking training, and ways in which we can enrich that learning practice beyond simply a, okay, we're providing some workbooks, we're doing some coaching, the workplace is involved in a coach and buddy system. What potential there may be for e-learning to embed into that as well.
I just want to preface what I have to say with something like, I wish I had a job that sent me to chocolate factories.
It was really, we actually walked out of there and there were still chocolates on the table. So.
Well, firstly, you may have already seen, but the first place to look here is J. Cross.
Mm.
You're already familiar with J.
Cross.
Yeah, I mean that's my answer is J. Cross. I'm very much in sync with what Jay has to say on a lot of stuff. We've talked about this and we've met several times about this, and I have some differences with him, but not very many differences. Obviously, learning and work are becoming integrated. Learning and life are becoming integrated. And so, it becomes two sets of questions. The one set of questions is technological. How do we pull this off? And there are two types of answers to that. The one answer is web services, and the other answer is my kind of answer, which is RSS. So there are actually two flavors of the same answer, really. And the idea is learning content embedded into workplace applications so that you don't need to go somewhere to learn. You don't need to stop what you're doing to learn. The learning becomes part of the use of the thing. So, and this is going to be a long process because there are many ways things can be embedded, but they will be embedded. I've talked lots about learning as being not static things. This is back to the librarians again. Learning being but not static things. Learning not being objects, but learning being a type of infrastructure which should flow through an environment the way water or electricity does. And then it becomes a question of the wiring and that kind of infrastructure. And the answer to that is going to be some kind of combination of remote accessing technologies within a range, web services through to REST, representational state transfer, through to RSS, through to the little JavaScript thingies that I write, and so on. It will be a range of these things. And so the idea, the thinking here that needs to happen is pick something, anything, any environment, any place. How would learning work within that thing? I do that all the time. This is where I get all my ideas. Because I just take ordinary, everyday experiences and I say, well, what if we added learning to that? I mean, the way to think of it is, any place where there's writing, there could be learning, right? I mean, in fact, we use writing now, it's just all over. Wherever you need it, we have some writing. You know, you need to get out of the building in a hurry, well, there's probably some writing on the wall that tells you how to do that. So, And so you sort of create scenarios. The famous one that I did at Networking 2001 in Brisbane was the fishing rod that teaches you how to fish, right?
And you know, because you've got your PDA or whatever with you, right? You're wearing some kind of information appliance, and as you come into proximity with that fishing rod realizes that it's in the presence of somebody who has wireless mobile enabled learning. So your fishing rod is ready, and then you cast your rod, and your fishing rod comments, you've never fished before, have you? and on it goes, right? Like you've described that. Another one is coming back from Charlottetown to Moncton. We stopped, there's a little spot, because they built a big bridge now to Prince Edward Island. And at the base of that bridge now there's a little village and little tiny shops and things like that. We're in one of these shops and looking at strawberry jam, and there had been people at the conference we attended talking about the marketing of strawberry jam, and I'm thinking about that and looking at this little thing of strawberry jam, and why doesn't the strawberry jam teach you how to use strawberry jam? Teach you all about strawberry jam, right? But that technology exists today. Right. Stick a little RFID into the label of the strawberry jam. You're, again, wearing your learning appliance. So the RFID contacts your learning appliance, directs your learning appliance to some materials available on the internet related to strawberry jam. Right. Now, that interacts with your personal profile, so that, because you don't want to get information only from the strawberry jam company. We just call that advertisement. They tried that with QCAT, didn't work. All right, so it's pulling a wide range of information relevant to you about strawberry jam, because you're currently interested in strawberry jam. We know this because you're holding it, you're looking at it. And so all of this now becomes available to you. So again, it's this idea of thinking about where learning can be applied in the process. So that's the first issue. The key thing, though, is the second issue. This is where Jay and I sometimes cross a little bit. Well, that's kind of a neat little play on words there. And the issue boils down to this. Who's in control? Right? You have a worker in the workplace who's determining what the learning will be, how the learning will take place, what the learning style will be, so on and so forth. Right. And the thing is, people draw this picture of workplace learning, and it's this command and control model again. All right, and the objectives of this learning are supposed to be in order to improve ROI, in order to improve worker productivity, things like that. You know, that's not what the worker thinks about when the worker goes to work in the chocolate factory. The worker doesn't walk into the door and say, I'm going to improve my ROI today. This is what I want to do today. Mostly that's not what they do. They have other objectives, other things that they have in mind. I'm going to make some money so I can go to the island today, or so on and so forth. So it seems to me that for workplace learning ever to really be effective, as opposed to being marginally effective the way it is today, that it's the same answer as the producing content answer. It has to be something that they would do anyways. Right? It has to be worker-directed. It's so in the process of working, but something that they want to do because they get a benefit out of it. So it doesn't make them more productive, it makes the job easier. Right? It doesn't serve to increase the ROI, it improves the employability of the person. Right? It's because people always talk about workplace learning from the point of view of the benefit of the company, but it's the worker who has to do all the work. So it has to be to the benefit of the worker. So, and the thing is, in a chocolate factory, you will find, I'm sure you did find, people who are genuinely interested in chocolate, and not just the management. I mean, I would consider a career in a chocolate factory. And they want to learn about chocolate, but they want to learn about what interests them about chocolate, not what interests management about chocolate. So, I mean, you can still have workplace learning that is worker-directed, that improves the company bottom line, even though it's not directed by the company. And for those of you who wonder whether I have a consistent theory, this goes right back to what I was saying at the beginning of the day about distributed decision making and getting away from the hierarchical command and control, autonomy, working in clusters, autonomous agents, all that sort of stuff. Same principle. How was that?
Great.
Steve, how would you measure, what tools would you use to measure whether that e-learning is being productive to the company? Because the company's not going to create e-learning just to necessarily enrich its workers wanting some return. Apart from great financial returns, what other measures can be applied to create environments where learning is valued at a whole range of levels?
Well, okay. How do I want to put this gently?
There is only one relevant measurement for companies, and that's bottom line. Because companies, strictly speaking, are in a certain sense pathological. All they want is earnings. Right? So the only relevant measure of learning is earnings. But the problem is, and this is really important to keep in mind, that there is not a direct, and never will be, a direct cause and effect relationship between learning and earnings. And in fact, there will never be a direct cause and effect relationship between anything and earnings. Because companies aren't simple cause and effect systems. Companies are complex systems. They're ecosystems. The interaction of employees and information and goods and things like that within a company has effectively the same structure as, say, something like a food web in an ecosystem where you have sharks and barracudas and jellyfish and squids and so on. And, you know, you can't simply measure, if you do something over here, is it going to have an output there? Because it depends on a broad range of things. So you have to look at it from the perspective going in that you're probably not going to see an ROI, and that kind of kills the measurement.
They can't encourage companies. They can't see the connection.
But now we come into the how do I put this gently part. It's not my fault if companies are stupid. Okay, I can't fix that. Right. If they're still working on a cause-effect paradigm to measure the effect of learning on anything, I can't come up with a magical solution that says this is so. And indeed, I will be even take it even further. If that is the principle under which they are operating, then they are probably gradually making themselves less and less competitive. Because they are using an incorrect metric, an incorrect system of measurement in order to assess the effectiveness of their actions. Okay, so how do you determine an ROI? You model, the best you can do is model the company, create a simulation of your company. Now, of course, you have to sit there and calculate the ROI of this simulation, and the simulation now becomes a variable in your simulation, but we'll leave that aside. Because as much as I love recursion, this isn't the place for it. But if you have the money, you model the company and try to get as detailed a model as you can, and then you start playing with the inputs. And you may, and you'll get results to within a certain percentage of error, depending on the accuracy of your model. But, I mean, right now, I think that the state of the art of workplace modeling is, well, there is such a state. There is a state of the art, but I don't think it's anything near what we need in order to make reliable predictions out of this. We're still in the world of one model fits all businesses. And, you know, you come up with these business gurus who come up with these models and say, oh, look at this model. This model will fit everything. And that's how we got total quality management. It's how we got Sigma 5 or 6 or 8 or whatever. You know, but of course that's not the case. Each company has its own model, its own picture of the knowledge, structures, relations, information flows, and so on. Within each one of these structures, if you tweak the capacity of an employee, it will have a ripple effect. I mean, what's the effect in a company? Let's flip this around. What's the effect in a company of not providing something strictly and solely for the benefit of its workers? You know, I mean, there was an interesting article. I don't think I carried it in my newsletter, but there was an interesting article that did a side-by-side comparison between Walmart and Costco in the United States. So Walmart and Costco are pretty much in the same business selling, you know, big box, sell everything kind of stores.
Big W?
Oh, my. Okay. Sure. So, anyhow, Costco employers are paid more. Costco employers are unionized. Costco employers, employees have benefits, like health benefits and that. Walmart, they're paid less. They're non-union. There aren't these benefits and so on. Guess which store makes more money?
Walmart.
Costco. On a per employee basis, Costco kills Walmart.
To support that before we move on, I was at an ROI in e-learning conference in Sydney last week, and companies are currently being monitored on the stock exchange as to how much learning they're providing for their workers and how much control the workers have on their learning. And those shares are skyrocketing at the moment, as well as the profits of the companies, because they're investing in learning for their employees. We need to move on. We've got one more to go, and I'd ask if we could keep it fairly brief.
Yeah.
Kristen, if you could focus on a question or two you'd like to ask.
Yeah, I'm
so I've got 25 minutes then for the other questions that we haven't even got to yet.
Well, I can actually keep it brief because luckily Stephen has separated to our workshop at the Learning Edge up in Canberra a couple of weeks ago, so I don't really need to get into this. For those of you that maybe less familiar, just refer to Phil's LEAP architecture project. We're actually a combination of the Resource Centre, which is our Learning Object Repository, the Activity Centre, which is our delivery platform for students, and the e-planner, which we call the Activity Assembler, or in our Blackboard environment, we actually now call the Blackboard Content Authoring Tool, or BCAT, which is a new solution and offering. As you can see, I've got the commercial angle of the e-learning market, and we have to invent acronyms, and we've actually got a little cat logo that's going to appear in our marketing brochures pretty soon to go along with that.
Just make sure it doesn't look like Napster's.
The Learning Edge, we've got about 16 customers now. We're only focusing on the Australian market. We've got four universities. We've got TAFE here, but we're about to sign up on the other TAFE, Southern Queensland. And I'm focusing on now on the TAFE market. I guess my interest is for next year will be overseas. I'll be interested to hear Stephen's opinion of the overseas markets, which ones will be hot to trot for learning object repositories, which ones are more proactive, especially bearing in mind we do have to go off the back of WebCT and Blackboard customers mostly, whether there are any other potential allegiances, alliances we should look at. So
I'm going to come at you a little off the wall, although do look up something called Ensemble Collaboration. They're based in New Brunswick.
Yep.
There's probably an affinity there for you.
Yep.
Here's my off-the-wall comment. How detailed a patent check did you do at the U.S. Patent Office? And here's my thinking. Patents in the U.S. are used as trade policy.
Right.
And basically, whether or not they actually printed anything, you have to go through this as a cost of business of doing or a cost of doing business in the United States. So I think it would be significant pretty ask yourself what that cost is, because you're going to lose your case, whatever it is, right? Because you're from away. So
even with the free trade agreement,
yeah. Oh. Don't get me going about the free trade agreement.
Sorry, back on track.
But I mean, the agreements that one side follow only when it's convenient to their own national self-interest are hardly worth the paper they were signed on. But we'll leave that aside.
Sorry.
But I mean, but that's just, you're going to run into patent stuff as a cost of doing business in the United States.
Yeah.
So, despite the fact that it looks like this big money tree, I would avoid it for as long as possible. And work around the edges. That's, no, let me see.
That's Canada.
Well, that's Canada. Yeah.
Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. Canada, Mexico. Get into Europe before software patents hit. Make sure you're first in line when the money tree starts over there. Because there's widespread opposition to software patents in Europe, so naturally they're going to pass it. I don't know. We'll do a Google or a Yahoo or whatever, sign a massive deal with China.
I mean, learning object repositories in your space, is Ensemble collaboration one of those?
Or? Ensemble collaboration is kind of neat. What they've done is they've created what they call collaboration objects. And collaboration objects are like learning objects, except they're collaboration opportunities. And the idea of collaboration objects is that they're embedded in or linked to existing learning objects. And Ensemble's been signing deals with various, because they're in that mode, right? Signing deals with various LMS providers, like I forget who they've signed with, so I don't know if they've signed with WebCT, but with vendors like WebCT. Again, if you do a search for Ensemble and Strategic Alliance or something like that, you'll find the list. I've seen them coming through in the business side. I just haven't been carrying them in the newsletter. So, yeah, it's kind of a neat thing. I didn't see that directly in nurse. I think it's the capacity that would help your system. Exactly how, I'm not sure. But it feels to me like there's a synergy there. Again, don't forget, you know, like I'm not an MBA or anything like that, so I don't really.
Neither the top 500 CEOs in America.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a good point. So, but what distinguishes them from me is that they have money. No, I'm just kidding. If I had to give any advice whatsoever, it's like be really wary of the United States. Because they will take as much from you as they possibly can. So and so you need to be in a position to defend against that when it inevitably happens. I didn't mean to launch an anti-American tirade, but I mean, go read about the history of Research in Motion. There's the whole story in a nutshell right there. They're still in business, but I don't know how. Because they had to pay huge fortunes in this business. Unofficial business tax.
Chris, I would suggest, particularly when I visited Canada as a flexible learning leader, that my observation was that everything was done in partnership, so education and business partner.
Yeah, that's true.
You started that model in a small way here in Tasmania. I think that's one of the keys you've got to continue doing.
Yeah, but if and how we can extend that to another country is, it's hard enough just extending it to another state.
Yes, I know.
Well, I mean, at some point you're going to have to make the corporate decision whether or not you're going to do golf course wear. And from the sound of it, that's the route you want to go. And now, of course, you're going to have me on the other side arguing against golf course wear, but I mean, you know, I mean, from strictly business proposition, you want the strictly business advice. The strictly business advice is get yourself or some marketing people to go hobnob with university presidents and things like that. Get to know them. Go to their conferences. You know, don't bother with the conferences with the users. Go to the presidents. do some glossy presentations, you'll make enough sales to get you going to the next level, at which point you can hire more marketing people. Don't spend your money. This is, you want business advice? This is the business advice. Don't spend your money on development. Get a minimal product there that looks like it'll do the job, and then market it like that. Is that the advice you want? I mean, I may not have an MBA, but I can do business. You should be happy I'm not in business.
All right. Thank you very much for all of that. It's taken a lot longer than I anticipated, but I think we've gained a whole range of valuable comments, and thank you very much, Stephen. What I want to go on to now are the questions. I think we've got something like 25 or 26. We're not going to get through all of them, but there are probably two sectors, I think, that have missed out a bit in interacting today, and I would see that being the University of Tasmania, and particularly industry, and there's only a couple of industry reps left now, and I hope that's not indicative of the fact that you've been on the outer a little bit. So before we launch into those questions, I'd like to ask specifically of anything you would like answered from Stephen Downes before we do move on.
Apparently not.
Obviously not.
There are people are still in the room, so I'm ahead of the game.
Okay, we'll move on, and I suppose we need to try and draw some gems out of these, but to give the uni a bit of a go, I believe this was your question, measuring the value of e-learning within organisations.
Yes, I've already.
Have you got enough on that at this stage?
I've already had posed that question to some degree, and I've heard that there's conflicts. I don't think necessarily that being conflicts means that it's not worthy of examination, but I want to get to see you get excited again. I want to talk about the US military as a learning organisation, because you said before, or whatever, it could take as an entire higher education, etc., and I appreciate that. What lessons can we take from the US military as a learning organisation? Because I'm going to say something contentious, because I think in some ways that they are a successful organisation.
Well,
based on the number of people I kill, or
I think the first part of that is, when you think about it, is kind of an obvious answer. If you have enough funding, you can do almost anything.
That's right.
I mean, ADL got $800 million to play with, and then they of course awarded that contract to PricewaterhouseCoopers. The funding helps. there are aspects in which the U.S. military is a successful learning organization. There are aspects in which they're not.
What aspects do you think they are successful that we can learn from?
Well, insofar as they're decentralized, insofar as the learning occurs at the lower levels, I think they're successful. I mean, they have a very specific, how do I want to put this gently? Because I'm going to her again.
Amongst Australians, you can say whatever you like.
Oh, yeah.
We are an independent country, despite what the papers say.
Yeah. No, I'm saying that just to stall for time.
Move that thing around. That's
I mean, there are certain really major, important ways in which they're not a learning organization. Witness recent events. But, if you have a command and control environment, and if you have an environment where there's a really strong incentive to learn, because otherwise you die, then you can probably be successful with enterprise learning. And if you have a lot of money, that's the message. What can we learn? The U.S. military is a completely unique organization. The conditions do not exist anywhere else. And so, the first thing I would say is if you're learning lessons from the U.S. military, think about the assumptions that underlie the lessons that you're learning, right? I mean, because it really is, it's a life or death command and control well-funded. treatment. That applies nowhere else, right? Because everywhere else where it's life and death, the funding isn't there, you know. So
they're very incestuous as well, in that they don't collaborate with anyone else. Essentially, they are very much insular. They might seem to collaborate with other
organizations. A lot of that is marketing.
Yeah.
Okay. They do collaborate. They bring. I mean, the U.S. military consumes all, right? They bring stuff in, but it's never branded as the external stuff. SCORM is a good example. Was created by Canadians. Created specifically by Peter Holt and Roger St. Pierre of Canadian National Defense. Who knows that, right? Because it's a U.S. military thing, but that's what they do. They bring the stuff in, it's theirs. They own it, they brand it, they invented it, no matter where it came from. So they look insular. The phrase U.S. military industrial complex is accurate. It's no accident. It's no accident that the internet developed the way it did, because of course it was a U.S. military initiative. But what made that happen was that the U.S. military is not insular; it's very closely and tightly connected to the academic and the corporate sector in the United States. That's why they needed a network, was to get this, you know, to facilitate this collaboration. So. But one aspect in which what you say is true is the U.S. military does whatever it wants, no matter what. So if the U.S. military wants something, that's what it does. You know, if it wants a country, that's what it gets. and it actually has several countries around the world it can use as it wants. You know, maybe the lesson in that is there's something to be said for goal-directedness.
Thank you, Rob. Right,
yes. I don't know if that helps.
No, that's good. Thank you.
Kirsty, the next five dot points, starting at personalisation of learning, were your questions. Would you like to pick a couple of gems out of that or try and get some coverage from Stephen on those? It's personalisation of learning, knowledge in learning, issues in e-learning, the new student, and communities of practice.
For people listening on the tape, the variability of the quality of the responses is solely the fault of the... No, I'm just kidding. Entirely based on the questions.
I probably pick one of those, the key one that I go for is the personalisation of learning.
Sure.
You've talked about what to me sounds out there in the future about how we can personalise learning, the merging of and creating a new desktop that interacts with the person based on
objects and the people and matchmaking, if you like. I wondered your perspective on what can we do now with the tools that are available to your average practitioner and your an relatively average learner.
Okay.
Here and now.
Can I add one of your other questions into that?
Mm.
About the new
student? Well, that's integrated into it there. Mm.
Just thinking, because I'm watching this little thing here and it's dead silent as I'm thinking the thing between them.
Almost flatline.
Almost flatline, yeah. I mean, I've got a whole theory about how this works. Problem with it is it can't be done with today's tools. So, I mean, in a certain sense, your question is, you know, how can you fly from New York to London in 6 hours using schooners? And in a sense, you can. Right? In a sense, you can't do it. So that was my first thought. Right? You're asking how to go to the moon with 19th century technology, you know, unless you're Jules Verne, it's not on. The second thought that I had, and this would be about second, three, or four of that long pause, because people ask me sometimes, so how do you make decisions? Which
I'm probably the last person to ask if they ask me. And in the context of things like government policy and so on and so forth. And what I say to them is what I do, and that is find your endpoint, whatever it is, and yours will be different than mine, and it may be similar, it may be different. If you're talking about personalization of learning, let's say that's your endpoint. Your endpoint is personalization of learning. And try to be as clear about articulating what that endpoint is, because a lot of times, especially in institutional environments, the endpoint is in fact jargon, and nobody knows what it is. So, I mean, and it's on tape, so I can say this. When I did the session in the afternoon in Adelaide, and they wanted to improve collaborative mechanisms, and so I asked them. I began by asking, "Well, what's wrong with what you're doing now?" And there was no answer. They didn't know what the endpoint was, so we ended up spending basically the entire session trying to wrap our minds around the problem, because they didn't have a clear, you know, they knew, they had an idea of a solution, they wanted me to map out the solution, but they didn't have the question right. So, define the endpoint. Articulate it as clearly as possible, understanding that this, in many cases, this would be your personal endpoint. Other people have their personal endpoints. There will be points of collaboration, which is great, because that's the stuff you can work together on. There will be points of difference, and you just avoid those areas, because you're just going to fight about them. But as an individual, once you've defined your endpoint, then that becomes the basis for making your decisions. And everything you do, everything, and without exception, either leads to this endpoint or it doesn't. If it doesn't lead to the endpoint, don't do it. And if it does lead to the endpoint, do it. It sounds ridiculously simple and naive, and in a sense it is, but you have to keep in mind, because there's a whole bunch of other people out there, a lot of them are actually working toward their endpoint. They're trying to get you to do things that lead to their endpoint, and may actually draw away from your endpoint. So sometimes you have to balance how much they will help you get to where you want to go versus how far they're pushing you away from where you want to go. Because a lot of the questions that were asked today were along the lines of, well, how do I accomplish such and such in an environment where the direction is against that, right? And the simple answer is you have to look at the trade-off, and you have to measure how far will they push you away versus how far will you move toward, because there's always a trade-off. And if you're in a position where the action you take pushes you further away, dig in your heel. That's where you pick your fights, and you have to pick your fights. I pick fights, and I don't like fighting, but things like that. And I have an endpoint. My endpoint is what's sitting on my webpage, the thing on the side. That's my endpoint. And everything I do leads to that endpoint. Now, I do trade-offs. I give Chris some business advice. that's a little facetious. But there are trade-offs. There are things that I do in my place of employment that don't lead to that endpoint. I actually sent in a patent suggestion the other day because, well, I figure if I give them a patent suggestion every once in a while, they will keep employing me. And that allows me to move closer to my endpoint. And happily, I can count on their internal mechanisms not being very good, so that they probably will never actually make it into actually being a patent, so I don't need to worry about it. But even if it did, right, it's this trade-off. So sometimes you have to give up some of what you want in order to get it. But the key is find that endpoint, lock on it, and never waver. And so, and I know that had nothing to do with personalization and learning, but now, defining the objective, what is personalization and learning? I wrote a paper called In Practice, because I went to a conference in San Diego and met up with David Merrill, and so we had a long and interesting conversation about learner-centered learning, and it emerged that learner-centered learning meant something very different for me than for him. For me, learner-centered learning means the learner directs the learning. For him, it was the learner directs the learning, but somebody else tells them what to do. So, yeah, we had a great old conversation about that one. That's what I wish I had recorded. Because we started it the evening before and then carried it on in the session. It was great and wonderful. A great, real nice person. And we have a lot in common. We differed on that. For me, learner-centered learning, personalization in learning, is in the first instance generating the capacity for the learner to locate, choose, and use resources as determined by their own good, where that is defined as them pursuing their own good in their own way. Okay, now that's the marketplace view. Right, that's the distributed view. Some call the marketplace view these days communism, but we'll leave that aside. It's one of these delicious ironies, right? You give power to individuals so that they can act as agents, autonomous agents in a marketplace, and that's somehow anti-marketplace. But anyhow, we'll leave that aside. So then now that has become the question of how do you present the range of learning opportunities to a person, and how do you create a mechanism where they can select from these opportunities, and how can you create an environment in which they can actually take advantage of these opportunities? But now we've got three separate questions. And now we're breaking it down into quite a bit of detail. Now, the standard answer to the first question is usually the one-word answer, metadata. The long answer is what I call resource profiles. But the idea here is that there is a triad. I need to remember this triad. It is actually on another tape, so I'm not worried that it's lost forever in history. But between the person who's using the resource itself, and the context in which the resource is used. And the idea here now is to come up with as precise a description of each of those things involving the least amount of effort put into creating that description, such that you can match up a resource given a user and a context of use. In theory, you should be able to match up from any two points to get the third point. So you have a resource and a context of use. You can pick out probably who it would apply to, right? If you have a resource and a user, you can probably pick out when it would be useful. But the idea is you have these three things, because at any given point in time in a person's life, you'll have two of them. You'll have the person, and you'll have the context. And so the question now just simply becomes the selection of the resource. So now we're down to the question of describing these things and the mechanisms for producing descriptions of these things. And now we're going to move to a very sub-level sort of thing, where we're talking about generating a system whereby metadata, whatever that means, is generated for each of these three things: the person, the resource, and the context, in an automated way, such that this metadata can be retrieved by any entity in the network at any time, because otherwise it's useless. And so when I talk about a lot of stuff, I talk a lot about the resource metadata in particular, which is what resource profiles is itself about. And to make a very long story short, what we want to do is generate data about this resource as it is created and used, not as a separate process. And in the resource profiles paper, I identify three major types of metadata that would describe this resource. And as an aside, those three types of metadata can also be applied to people and can also be applied to context. And the three types of metadata I call first party, second party, and third party metadata. First party metadata about a resource is authored by the creator of that resource. It's the bibliographic metadata. Author, title, and so on. It's the kind of metadata that's produced by Blogger when you create a blog entry. Right, so it's metadata that's created automatically by the system in the process of creating a resource. Second type of metadata is called second-party metadata. It is metadata created by the user at the time of use. And more accurately, is created by the environment in which the user uses the resource at the time of use. It would include, for example, the context of use. This person looked at this picture inside a history class. And therefore, part of the description of that resource is it was used in a history class. And that leads to the suggestion that maybe, just maybe, it's a history resource. Now, it's not only a history resource. It can be used in a wide variety of applications, but it's at least partially a history resource because it was used in a history class. And then finally, third-party metadata is metadata that's created by people who are neither the producers nor the users of the object. They are therefore neutral third-party observers. Typical examples of third-party metadata would be the classification of a resource by a librarian. See, the librarians are back. because they are experts in classification, the consistent application of classification schemas. Siskel and Ebert produced classic third-party metadata. They used a very simple metadata schema. Two thumbs up, two thumbs down, or one of each. Three-part metadata. So, and any sort of evaluative metadata. Classification, any sort of way of describing this from a third-party perspective. So you have your metadata about the object, you have your metadata about the context, you have your metadata about the person, and again, I could talk about the creation of personal metadata. That's much less well-developed out there now than resource metadata. I don't know why, but it is. All this talk about profiles is a tentative first step, not necessarily in the right direction, but in the right direction, but not necessarily with the right objective. In the world of RSS, there's a thing called FOF, friend of a friend, which again is person metadata. So you have these three sets of metadata, and these sets of metadata. How do I want to put this? Because the dominant model, the dominant paradigm that we use is a just-in-time search kind of model, right? You need to find something, you go to Google. But when we know all of this stuff ahead of time, which we do, then these can become, should become, will become parameters for the design of the network that connects you and your resource. So, I can't do it in the time that I have without some dramatic hand waving.
And time is running out.
But the idea is there is a network of interconnections between the producers of the resource and the consumer of the resource in the context. And this network is constituted of a variety of intermediaries. And the metadata describing each of the components of that network feed into the network and actually design the construction of that network. They inform the construction of that network. And in fact, as the metadata changes, the structure of the network itself changes. simple example. Part of the network might be an RSS aggregator, and as your interests change, the set of RSS aggregators that your system uses may change, so that you access different RSS aggregators at different times. So you think of there is an intermediary network, and then we finally get to the presentation and use of the resource. And the idea is, in a context of use, any context of use, a fishing rod, strawberry jam, a learning object browser, whatever, that actually forms the top end, the surface, if you will, of the network that I've just described. All of these connections are already in place. When you go to search for something, the search has already taken place, and the results are present in the current construction of the network. And all you need to do is ask for it. And depending on your options, 1, 2, or 100 highest quality results will be produced for you, given the context of what it is that you're up to at a given time. That's how personalization works.
Thank you for that statement. We've got time for one last question, and I was going to ask Stephen Brain to pose his question to Stephen, and then I need a couple of minutes to wrap up. But you may have had most of that answered.
I think I have most of that answered. It's almost like he was handing everything over to Google style search with a bunch of RSS feeds to rely on what's useful as a learning object and what isn't. It's a lot more complex than that.
It's a lot more complex than that. But the irony is, it's a lot more complex than that, but none of the pieces are as complex as Windows. The pieces are simple. It works because the components of this thing are simple. And in fact, almost the simpler each component is, the better it will work. And there are ways I can explain that, and there's even mathematics to support that. But the thing is, the more complex any entity in the system, any entity of this network is, the more likely it is that the network will produce invalid results.
All right. I'd like to wrap up if we could, and in saying thank you, Stephen. Firstly, I'd like to thank you for noticing our Luddite approach to keeping track of what's going on here today, and we'll correct that. Make sure it works for us. We also like to acknowledge your caveat that you put on the meeting at the beginning, that we sprung a few things on you, but we've enjoyed the process very much so. You made some mentions that in project we need to insert risk management and don't dictate outcomes and conditions.
All right, we're on again.
There you go.
So I just need to restart it.
So, okay, I'll start there again. We acknowledge your caveat. In project management, you've advised us to insert a bit of risk management and not be very strong on conditions and outcomes. You also mentioned that the networks should impose as little resistance to the project as possible. A comment on Centra was that it's doing a lot, but don't overlook open source. Standards at the synthetic level are being forgotten. Iterations and implementation is a must. Particularly, you referred that to the LEAP project. And standards don't have to have as much clout as is currently being experienced, and that could make things work a little bit better for us. Protocols are a better way to go rather than having standards. Are we putting in structural incentives for education? We need to pursue open source, but it is still not ready for the prime time. The system needs to be readaptable. Systems that are centralised don't work as readaptable systems. The systems have to overcome the logistical issues for publishing, particularly in relation to what Joe was asking. We have to get over the business and social hurdles. We need to be disciplined to set aside time for receiving and processing information regardless of our location and time of the day. Do it digital and share it. PDAs are not so good at receiving content, but absolutely fantastic for user-created content. Learning and work and learning and living are becoming integrated and must do more so by improved web services, REST and RSS. workplace learning must benefit the worker. And 2 points finally, we must find and be very clear about our end point, then articulate that, and then that becomes the only way to make the end point achievable. And finally, openness makes it work. Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been very enlightening and very enjoyable.
It's a great summary.